I have just spent an hour and a half talking with Bella. And Joko Willink comes up again, this time in the form of a quote that I won't spoil. You'll just have to wait for it, but it is a good one. And I always get so much out of talking with Bella. Because she asks me insightful questions, which makes me not have to, but want to look at what's true about what I just said or stated or hypothesized. And does it sit well with me when I dig a little bit deeper? So I hope that you will also have fun with me, Bella, and a touch of Joko Willink. So enjoy. Hello, my friend.
Hello.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. How are you?
I'm good. But it's I've been recording the fourth conversation with everybody but you. And then Friday I start to record the fifth conversation, which is like the official last of the solo conversation, so to speak. So, but we've still got this one and another one. So this feels a little bit luxurious.
To just have that extra time.
That extra time. Yeah, precisely. I'm good. I've been gaining some insights into the shoulding part of myself, which has been quite special, actually. So, yeah, it's been good.
Do you want to elaborate?
Well, I do want to, but I first want to just hear how you are.
I actually feel like my life has attacked me from 180 different places. So,
oh, wow.
in just so many ways that I have to frazzle my mind in order to deal with many different things all at once, that I feel like it will be grounding to focus on you first for me.
If perfect. That's no worries. No worries.
Just because I need to like come off of this, you know, everything. Handling way too many things all at once. Yeah. Kind of a mindset.
Yeah. I've been, let's see, how many meetings have I had today? I've been in 1, 2, 3. Yeah, this is my fifth meeting for the day. And I haven't had the time yet, because they've been quite long meetings, all of them, to go for a walk. So that's my treat. After this conversation, I will go for a walk so that I get some grounding. Because especially when I walk barefoot, that is what happens. I get grounded and I really, really enjoy that. But I had my shoulder. I was in therapy on Monday, and somehow the shoulder in me, the one or the ones, probably, because it can be several, they can have different flavors. My inner shoulders tell me everything I should have done, but kind of after the fact. You should have known that, or, you know, why didn't you do that? You should have understood that. It's like, so And they stop me as well. They do stop me. It is this mental vice that I think we spoke about last time. This, the thing that kind of holds me back. There's a lot of shoulds in that one.
You know, they say that hindsight is 20/20.
Yeah.
So all those shoulders, they are using information that you could not have had.
Precisely, precisely, which is precisely the point that Dominic actually made in therapy, because he said, have you tried entering conversation with your shoulders? Maybe you can do left hand, right hand, or dominant, non-dominant hand writing and ask and say, hey, you, shoulder, if you know all of this, or if you knew all of this, why didn't you tell me before?
Exactly.
And he said, usually when you do that, they get quite uncomfortable because they don't want to be called out. And I was laughing. But he also said, and I think this makes sense, because he also said, if you do that, if you do enter into a conversation about it, it's like, how can we make a deal that if you see something beforehand, why don't you tell it to me beforehand in such a way that it can be of service, rather? Because he said, they're quite useful allies to have. So I'm going, yeah. I intended to sit down in bed and do a little bit of non-dominant handwriting this morning, but I didn't. I wasted my time on other stuff. But I do intend to do that because I don't really know what they will say or the one will say, because I don't know who I will be speaking to.
I think those shoulders, they are the parts of you that you shushed. And what I mean by that is it's the parts of you that didn't feel helpful, because those were the parts of you that, if they were not quieted, they would go against what felt safe to you. And so they're in the habit of sitting in the background, stewing until something bad happens. And then they pop and said, see, I told you so.
Yeah.
And
yeah, and it is a lot of the therapy for the past 6 months has centered around my inner child, the small me, the 3-year-old, the 5-year-old, the 7-year-old, the 6-year-old, the 8-year-old, that child me that was also shushed from outside, so that things that I saw, that I knew were true, that was like, this is relevant, was uncomfortable for others as well. Achoo!
Yeah.
Get some time. Thank you. So it is like this perpetuating cycle. It's like, oh, I'm not comfortable when you point out or see, refer to whatever, something. So I will shush you, which then, sorry, get so tired again. That will then make me internalize that voice and turn it on myself, and then probably on my kids. You know, I'm not comfortable when you, and then I will. So we keep on doing the cycle.
It's so funny because I feel like I'm exactly the person who makes my kid uncomfortable because I refuse to coddle or enable the uncomfortable. I keep going to the uncomfortable. Well, it looks like a hero, but it's a really dirty job. Because you get a lot of pushback.
Yeah.
And you get a lot of self-questioning. And you get to be the unpopular opinion, and people who have a tendency towards avoidance of discomfort as a means of mitigating it basically leave. And that's mostly okay, because I don't want friends, acquaintances, coworkers who, in order to be around me, have to avoid parts of me. But I don't get a choice with my child, because I'm the parent. I always will be there. And part of me doesn't want to be abandoned by my child, because my child is going to label me as the uncomfortable person who always pushes the uncomfortable buttons. But part of me is very sad that that opens the possibility of my child withdrawing, and me, in other relationship, I might be the one who walks away, but in this relationship, I cannot. But I'm the parent. The parent doesn't walk away. Once you're a parent, you're just there.
Yeah.
For all of it. That's the...
You're supposed to. That's what being a parent is. Not every parent does that.
Sure. But I want to.
Yes.
And I agree. Oftentimes, the easier thing is to walk away. To protect myself from this, like, sense that I'm going to get abandoned. And so all on this is to say that they're both risky. The one that shushes yourself up is risky because you lose yourself. And the one that speaks up is risky because you lose the other sometimes because of it. And there are many others that it's okay to lose, but there are some others that isn't okay to lose.
But I mean, doesn't it also at least come down to who I am, how I am, who I want to be, what my core the Jocko Willink quote of "it's not what you preach, it's what you tolerate" comes to mind. Yeah,
that's powerful.
I know, it is so powerful. I've had it with me ever since I read the book, but I just recently
I'm gonna write that down.
Saw it again. Yeah, it's not what you preach, it's what you tolerate. Which is this thing in me, when I cannot tolerate, or what I cannot tolerate, I don't have an option there. This one was big.
Give me just a moment. I had not heard that quote. And it's
wow.
So I'm with you again. Sorry. That needed to just kind of get put down.
I wonder if I didn't bring this one up with Luke as well, but it is, it's in what I tolerate, what I let slide, pass me by, you know, that can be part of a slippery slope of me not honoring my boundaries. And again, somewhere there's a line. I want to believe somewhere there's a line where I've come too far. It's like it's just not possible anymore. But if it's a slippery slope, you know, just a gradual decline, maybe one day you wake up and you're just, shit, the distance between what I preach and what I tolerate is huge. Where was my boundaries again? What was my values? Who do I want to be? How do I want to be?
So boundaries are always tied to the context of the moment, in my opinion. And the way I mean that and the way I understand that is that I have a boundary with a person, and that person in a specific moment wants to push the boundaries. If I don't consciously examine that and acknowledge that this is a push of a boundary, I give up my agency to determine whether I want that boundary pushed or not. If I consciously to myself say, this boundary is being nudged right now, that gives me the choice to say, okay, maybe I'm okay with it being nudged today as long as it doesn't set a precedent for tomorrow. Or, okay, maybe I'm okay for this month for it to be nudged by an inch, but not by five. But once you acknowledge it, then you actually have the ability to determine when and how much you want that boundary pushed. And then when you get to that new spot where you thought you could go, ask yourself, well, am I okay here or do I need to walk it back?
There's agency and empowerment in that. Like it's on me.
Because you then take that power to determine whether you want to allow that nudge of boundary. And then you have the power to say, today we're not nudging that boundary. Sorry. Or, hey, today I have capacity to nudge it a centimeter. And tomorrow I need to walk it back. Or tomorrow I need to re-examine and see how it feels. But if we don't acknowledge to ourselves that a boundary is being moved, it's slipping on that slippery slope, we are living under the illusion that that boundary is staying the same. We're like looking away from the fact that the boundary is being pushed. And we always do that when we want to be good kids. Because yeah. We don't want to be the one who like says, hey, you're pushing that boundary, as if saying that is somehow criminal. And it really is up to us to say, oh, I see you're pushing that boundary. Well, guess what? I think I'm okay with that today, but like I'll have to reexamine tomorrow. And by saying that, then you actually kind of let the pusher of the boundary know that you're up on their game. And that you are allowing it or not allowing it, and how much you're allowing. And all of a sudden, you're in charge.
Yeah. Which is interesting because I'm just linking it to a project where there is no real efficient way to share documents. So documents are being sent willy-nilly, email back and forth, which also means when I need the latest version of X, where do I go? Who has the latest version of X? And is there maybe an X1, X2, X3 that should really be turned into a Y? But, you know, they are in different, you know, it's like just mayhem, which also means that if you then set up a place where we can share our documents, if people now are used to sending documents back and forth via email. If you set up such a system, then you also have to be very, very clear that when you next send me an email with a document attached, I will say thank you, but no thank you. Don't send me any emails with documents attached. Point me to where on the server, shared server, wherever I can find it. So this is a perfect example of that, the slippery slope. If I say, oh, never mind, you'll get it eventually. No, you won't, because I'm not telling you that, hey, this is enough. This is not the way that we are going to do things anymore. So it's a lightweight example where, again, the awareness and what I do with my awareness, which is agency, what do I actually do with it? It's the difference of this, because I can preach, but if I tolerate, no, we all but have to
there's
do
another
thing.
Aspect. Because you could preach, you could tolerate, or when you see that that boundary is being pushed, you could express your need. You can be the one who says, you know, for my sake and so that I can find the latest and most updated version easily and effectively, I need you to please put it in the shared server and not send it by email, because I get so many emails, it's going to get lost. And then I'm going to operate out of an older version and we're going to both suffer.
For me, that's the same.
But
it's just different ways of saying
it. But
it isn't.
Because
tell me what.
Because you spoke your need. Because you had the courage to say, this is what I need. And when you ask for something, people are actually more inclined to give it to you than when you tell them, hey, I'm not going to tolerate this boundary being crossed.
I think the reason why I'm not going, oh, is because I think I do that. I do turn into, and I've realized in the last couple of years that I think I incorporated that way of speaking to a large extent, which we also talked about in the beginning of the July conversation we had, where again, when I say for what I see, what I need for me to be able to, it works.
But it's something that, and this is something I've learned, like the things that are hard for us to do, or for me, I should speak really for myself, but what's hard for me to do, I tend to want to do it once and assume it's done and dusted and don't have to repeat it.
Seldom like
and
that,
actually,
isn't it?
Actually, everything we learn and change happens in very thin, gradual layers. So we have to redo it and redo it and redo it. And in that process, it stops being uncomfortable for the doer, actually. I am looking at it and maybe projecting myself into this situation, because I know that I don't have an easy time asking for my needs. And so I will ask once, like in a dire situation. I had to be in such a low place to call a friend to ask to talk to her just a few days ago. I had to come to the moment where I felt like if I don't, the consequence is going to be really dire. And I couldn't allow myself to ask for that, for her time, which she gladly and happily gives, before it came to that crisis point, because I don't feel comfortable asking.
So tell me more about that. Where does that uncomfortableness come from when you are so comfortable being uncomfortable, for instance, with your child?
Right? Good point. It's the culture of like, you don't. That's the selfless culture versus the selfish or self-centered culture. And it comes to the point where it becomes too much as well, where you don't draw attention to yourself. You don't go and like selfishly need things from others. Nobody owes you. So why are you demanding things of others? And that is something that I did grow up with. And the discomfort that I am able to draw with my child doesn't stem from that. It stems from my need to be authentic. And so in my society where I grew up, there was this like distinction that you can demand things of certain people, like that are really close to you, that are your family. You can expect that of kin, right? But you can't expect that from, I don't know, a casual friend. Actually, I stand corrected. You could expect it in my country of birth from a casual friend. But where I live, that's considered rude. Expecting to ask for needs and for friends to fulfill them is not considered specifically acceptable in the society I currently live in.
And there's a, is it expecting that is the thing where you come from? Is it an expectation that if I ask, no. You have to? No.
No, it's the asking. And that's another thing that I really felt like it enlightened me. There was an article that I should share with you about ask culture and guest culture. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you read it because it was on the Esther group.
No, I don't think so.
In certain culture, you only ask for a favor if you're reasonably sure that it's not going to be an imposition for the person to do you the favor. Because when you ask for a favor, you put that person in the polite position of having to say no to you. And the culture I live in, specifically like the Northern European sort of part of society that I tend to kind of get mixed with. Like I have British friends and Irish friends, and like they have that where it's impolite to ask for things unless you're tolerably sure that it's not going to be an imposition for the other person to fulfill your ask. Where I come from is the ask culture where, hey, can you loan me 3 pounds of sugar? Well, I don't have any. Oh, okay, thanks, bye.
Like, and it's, you know, no big deal.
Right. But that isn't always received that way. And I, knowing where you live, I wonder how much the guest culture prevails there, where you ask only in certain circumstances and only of certain people.
Yeah.
You don't ask of everybody.
Because well, so this is, again, I think this is where I'm at least starting to be the odd one out.
Uh-huh. Give me just a moment. One second. I'm having trouble with my microphone. Okay. Let me try this way.
There
can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I can.
Good.
Sorry. So I think that there are so many things that pop in my mind. The first one is I did a flow game training over the weekend, an online flow game training, which is a A game, an actual board game that's been around for 25 years or so. But the only way to get your actual copy of the board game, which is this inside my this little bag, is to actually do a host training. So I did that this weekend, and now the invite and the encouragement is there to now host flow games, so that I will get in the flow of hosting, right? And Tuke Paludan Möller, who's an older Danish gentleman, absolutely lovely. He's one of the people behind the Art of Hosting, which I think might be more well known for many than the flow game is. But he sent an email to everybody from the training, and he ended it with, if you need any assistance to get you to host a game before we have a third meetup in the end of October, just ask. And he ended by saying, to ask is nice. It is kind to ask. And I went, "Woo! I so love that. The invite that he brings by saying that is so great. Because again, I can feel so insecure. And can I, should I, the shoulders can have a field day when it comes to this, right? But I learned really how to ask when I was, when I became a single mom 5 weeks before the birth of my oldest child. In that situation, I started to really get good at asking. And I asked because I had needs.
And because you had no other choice, really.
That was true. So I started to ask, and people responded, and people said yes or said no based on their circumstances. And I really learned how to be fine with that. And especially my friend Jenny, who she's always been really easy with that, because you know that she will say yes if she can.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And if she says no, it's because she can't. And, you know, and no added value on top of that, just the clearness of that. It's a yes and it's a no. You know, it's either or.
No baggage attached to either.
No baggage attached to them, precisely. Which also means that, from that place, it's much easier to ask. So I have been asking people and have added on that. I actually specifically say that. A yes and a no. Both of them are welcome.
I do that too.
Yeah.
But in the context of what you were talking about, like where you get things emailed to you instead of them being put on a server, was that a guest culture or ask culture? Was that a person or people that you felt comfortable asking?
So that's such a hodgepodge of I think all sorts. And I haven't been involved enough to actually know that. I've been more sitting a little bit on the side, looking on with fascination.
And that could be your answer there, because when we don't know, we do the cautious thing.
But it's not because of that, though. It is not because I don't, it is because it isn't, you know, it is not. There are so many things that I can see that I could do there that I'm actually quite restrictive about what I say, where I say it, because you know, it's like there, it's such an easy place for people to just get overwhelmed by everything that there is to do to make sure that that project would be running smoother. So I don't have any sense in me that I'm not asking because I don't know if I'll get a yes or a no. It's like that is not a factor at all.
It's not whether you get a yes or a no that I'm trying to touch on, but whether by asking, their response is going to be yes with a baggage instead of no without baggage.
Yeah, and again, I don't have enough.
You don't have it.
You know, if so. So I'm not not asking because I fear it's the one or the other, or that I've seen the one or the other. It's like it's that project isn't there for me.
Right.
At least. And I mean, I've been uncomfortable saying that, in a sense, saying what I need, even though it isn't I, it is what I see that the project needs to be successful. I've said that, and people have responded sometimes quite emotionally. And it's like, that doesn't faze me. Because it's also, I wonder about this. Again, we were talking about the difference between professional and personal, and how you can say or be in one way in professional settings where it can be easier to state needs than in personal settings.
That's right. We did that conversation.
That was the beginning of July conversation, because it was right after that conversation I had with people from this project. And I think
this is the same project.
Yeah. It's the same project. And it's, you know, it's, I got asked yesterday by family if I could babysit on Saturday. And, you know, everything just said no, because I spent 5 hours Saturday, 5 hours Sunday in Zoom meeting, you know, the past weekend. So it's like, no shit. And I have something else scheduled locally here on Sunday. So it's like, I need. And I so appreciate them asking. I so appreciate them asking. And I know that if I were to say no, you know, it wouldn't be met with baggage. Let's put it that way.
Lovely.
But so I checked with my eldest, and it's like, if we do it this way, could that work? And, or if you bring the kids here, that works. So they will be bringing the kids here, and I'll have them for 5 hours or something on Saturday afternoon. It's like, that'll be fine. Because then, somehow it's like, because then I'm here.
Right.
And I think that's probably what I need more than anything. I need to be at home. Then having the kids around, that'll be fine, right? But also an aspect of me wanting to say yes, wanting to see if I could help them, is this fact that I want them to be able, or I want them to feel that they can keep asking. And but again, is it an imposition? Yeah, it's an imposition. Do I want to do it? Yeah, I do want to do it, right? So it's like this because there's a value there. There's a value that is greater than my imposition. Or there's a love that's greater than my imposition.
And it's not pushing your boundary.
No,
it is actually, you made the conscious decision that you're going to allow this quote unquote intrusion. So all of a sudden you're in charge.
Yeah, precisely. Precisely.
Because the ask was such that you had the option to say either yes or no equally.
Yeah.
Where when somebody sends you something on email after you've asked them not to, that's a violation of boundary. And I am experiencing that when I set a boundary and it's violated, what feels unfair and burdensome is that then I have to take the time and the energy to uphold the boundary that, to speak of the shoulders, should have been respected from get-go because I was clear in setting it. And then I have to make that decision, and I've done that lately, to say, I see that this happened. I set a very clear boundary this and that time ago, and this is in violation of it. I need this boundary to be respected, please. Or even though it imposes or pushes the boundary that I set thus and thus ago, I feel like the context warrants me letting that boundary slide for this circumstance. But it isn't.
Yeah, precisely. It's an exception.
For future. Mm-hmm. Or, you know what? Maybe that boundary was set at a time when it was needed and it's run its course, and maybe we can nudge it. Yeah. But then, like, you have the reins on that decision. Nobody is making that for you.
Yeah.
And when the shutters are shushed up, when it's time to get aware of that, then what can they do? They can only jump up and down when things don't go the way you would have wanted to. And then they are those annoying I told you so's. That.
Yeah. And again, how can I start to relate to those aspects differently? Oh, Rachel Clifton tweeted this morning, I think. I will find it. I will read it. She tweeted, healing isn't becoming the best version of ourselves, in air quotes. It's letting the worst parts of ourselves be loved. And I said,
be enough.
What if that is becoming the best version of ourselves? And she said she agreed. But somehow I connected that to what you were saying, that when I am there, when I am okay with all of the stuff that is me, with all of the inside me, all of the shoulders, all of the pleasers, all of the procrastinators, all of the inner kids and fear mongers and what else they are. Again, it's like I have so much greater ability.
Agency.
Yeah. Ability to choose the thing that's right in the moment. To go for, okay, we need a pinch of this shooter over here and a little bit of fearmonger, but mostly we need this this go-getter. But we need those to kind of, you know, rein it in a little bit. It's like that's the combination that's perfect right here, right now. It's like then I have the use of all of the instruments that is me.
Instead, but in order to have their use.
Yes, because
you have to recognize
of,
what they are.
Yeah. Precisely, if I don't know them, or if I shush parts of them because I'm so afraid of them, or, oh my God, that's so embarrassing, or I can, you know, I'm ashamed of this thing. Then I'm playing with a reduced orchestra. It's like it won't really be a grand philharmonic if there's just three instruments playing. It just won't. You know, it can sound great anyway, but it won't be a philharmonic piece. It'll
be a trio.
It'll be a trio, precisely. And if you want a trio, that's perfect. But what if you wanted the grand philharmonic? Then you've really not given yourself the opportunity to step up to the plate.
The thing that is needed.
Yeah.
And what I wanted to say to you is that, like, it's easy to see it in a theoretical conversation. Like, you're giving me a scenario, you're describing a scenario that I am completely uninvolved in emotionally. And because none of my emotions are here to include any of the context, it's really easy for me to see it. Which absolutely does not mean that I can see it in myself in a moment when my emotions are going through the roof. And I say this just like we kind of laughed because you asked me last conversation, when did you learn that? And I said, 2 minutes ago when I said it to you.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
And often these conversations have the power to remind us of those things because we're not activated in our fears and anxieties when we're having them. We're having them in a really comfortable space. But we also want to remember that when we are uncomfortable, they still stand. Those principles are still valid.
Yeah. I was listening to a Ramit Sethi episode of I Will Teach You to Be Rich, number 59, which is called 98% of our net worth is in real estate. Are we in trouble? Which you may or may not think, oh, that sounds great. But the interesting part was listening to this couple where one was didn't give a hoot about risk. And the other one was, oh my God, we are so overextended on risk that this is, you know, it's breaking me apart. But they were so fantastic in, you know, she was sharing that, you know, risk this, that, and the other thing, and how it makes her feel, and why, and what she would want, and how she thinks, etc. And then he was getting it, honoring it, seeing, huh, you actually have a point. I can see this, which means that maybe I can do this, that, and the other thing. And then he was sharing, I see these potential, this possibility, this is what we can do, etc., etc., etc. And she was responding, yeah, I can see that. So they were the perfect example how, because I've understood money issues between couples is one of the most contentious conversations or topics you can have. It's like super common. They were just fantastic in how they could talk about it, and you could, I mean, it wasn't as if they were numb. It wasn't, I'm not letting myself feel anything, or I'm putting on a show. You know, it's like, it felt like this was, so I just went, wow, what a fantastic couple that they are speaking like this to each other, rather than, you know, you're an idiot for not wanting to. Why can't you see that? We should this, that, you know, all of those things that are so easy to do when you are in your emotional kind of merry-go-round. So what the other thing I want to connect that to. I'm doing a program at the moment about positive intelligence. And it speaks about the inner judge and the inner saboteurs and the inner sage. And this is what I've been doing for the past 15 years, identifying this and working with this, even though I haven't used these words. But one thing I heard today was this, and I think it actually fits perfectly. It was, the saboteur berates and tells you what is not good and says, you should do better. But the sage celebrates what is good and joyfully wonders how you could do even better. So,
yes,
the same thing, but you can come at it from these two. And the shoulder comes from the saboteur perspective, right? It's like, it's that, oh, but you should, why didn't you? Can I turn that around into what would have happened if, or how could you take, you know, what's the learning from this until next time? Or what could you do now? So it's,
how am I going to improve on this positive experience?
Precisely, precisely.
The saboteur always operates out of fear.
Yeah.
The saboteur always sees that if they don't say this, or they don't forecast the doom that can happen, they're not going to avert it. But in order to forecast the doom, you have to believe that there is a scenario of doom. And a sage says, however this cookie crumbles, I'm going to like land on my feet.
Yeah.
And I think we, each of us, have situations in our lives where we're either one of those characters.
Yeah.
We can be both the saboteur and the sage within ourselves in different situations.
Yeah. And in the same situation, but different inner states. You know, am I in a good. Am I resourced mentally, emotionally? You know, I've slept, I've eaten, I've exercised, I've laughed, I've hugged, I've taken a swim, I've read a book, I've accomplished something. Much easier to come from a sage point of view than if, or to be resourced rather, than if I, you know, I haven't slept and I'm stressed out of my mind and fuck, the cat is dying and mom is killing me. You know, it's like, yada, 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 yada. Yeah, then you're not resourced. Then the same situation can totally just break you. So that
a very much state happened to me 2 days ago, yeah, where I was under-resourced,
yeah,
severely.
Yeah.
And the situation escalated to a pretty painful fight with my kid.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that it was only because of my lack of resources. But I wasn't being a saboteur at that moment. I was just being an under-resourced parent who was supposed to have several days off and whose co-parent got COVID, so I couldn't get my days off. Because I had to step in for a sick co-parent.
Mm.
So it isn't always a saboteur that does.
No.
That comes. It can be that under-resourced that you just don't have the capacity to take it on in, like, it becomes bigger than it should be
or it ought
to be or it is really.
Yeah.
Just like if you have a dislocated shoulder and somebody gives you a nice slap on it. Right.
I've never had one, but I can imagine that isn't what I would be wanting in the moment.
And yet, if your shoulder is not dislocated and same person gave you the same slap, it'd be like, oh, do it again. That felt good.
Yeah. The concept of inner resources, or if I am resourced or not, is another one of those where I've got to learn the phrasing from my friend Stellan. It's a phrasing, it's a way to describe it that makes sense for me, that I can kind of relate to, because it's like, if I want to make a stew for dinner and the fridge is empty, there's like 3 eggs and some butter. Okay. There won't be any stew because there's no resources for its stew, right? It makes so much sense. If I want to build a house and I have 2 planks and a brick, it's not going to be a house. You know, it just isn't. And the same goes for me inside. If I'm, you know, oh, I want to be this perfect mom. Yeah, but you have 2 eggs and some butter. It's like, you know, you don't have what it takes in the moment. And with that, for me, comes the invitation to do gentle with myself, to like trim down on my expectations in the moment, or to own up to the fact that, you know, we need to have this conversation about this thing, and it's an important one, but we cannot have it right now because I cannot have it right now because I'm not there. I don't have the ability to have that conversation. So it's a way for me to dance with myself in a sense, and to know, you know, when is it time for the really, really slow, just gentle, I can maybe move a little bit. And when can I do a full-on swing for an hour dance, right? It's like different resources around. And I can't always do the one or the other. It varies.
And it feels like some days you have all the resources and you're still sabotaging because of other fears.
Yeah.
And some days you have no resources. And out of 3 eggs and butter, you make quiche and vegetables somehow. You conjured these vegetables to put in the quiche, and you have no idea where they came from.
Yeah.
And that, to me, is more the saboteur and the sage.
Yes.
Because the sage is going to magically conjure vegetables that aren't in your fridge to make a quiche with your 3 eggs and butter.
Yeah.
And the saboteur is going to take all the stew vegetables that are there and overcook them and then throw them down on the sink with the pot or with the water.
Yeah. And that's an important distinction, because the sage and the saboteurs are always there to be had. You can always call one of them up. Who do I call up?
Great. Well, some days we need to call the saboteur, because that's the person who has the healthy fear of too much risk.
So I don't know about that one, though, because that's where I think that the sage is the one who's discerning. And I think with discernment,
yes,
you can get that thing that the saboteur is actually trying to say. That's the message from the saboteur, but the way the saboteur does it actually breaks me down. The sage can say the same thing, but in a way that builds me up. So I don't think that we need the saboteur in that way. I think it's there. I think I can learn how to flip it. I can learn how to see, ooh, that was saboteur. Let's take the good stuff that the saboteur is pointing to and use it from a sage point of view instead. So I'm not saying sage bad or saboteur bad, sage good. No, it is like Rachel was saying, it's like it's all of me. And I get to love all of me. I get to be all of me. But I can break myself down. I can build myself up. And the sage with discernment. Ooh, I like that one.
I get reminded this connects to me. For me, it connects to this. I think I told you I went to take a teacher's course this past summer. And one of the beautiful things about it was that the leader of this course says, we teach music in a non-judgmental environment. And we treat mistakes as information. A mistake is an information on its data. You extract what didn't work and go and change the aspect so it works next time. But mistakes are not a qualification of our value. And I think sometimes when we get the shoulders to be that loud, we can extract the data out of that information, out of that circumstance. And to me, the data is those shoulders are shooting because they didn't have the void or the space to notify me beforehand because I repressed them. And now they're being reactive because they didn't have the chance to be proactive. So what did I repress that became a shudder?
Do you have any clue?
Oh, it's different each time. Like for each person.
Yeah, but what did you have repress? Do you have any clues?
I do, sometimes. Like I had 3 weeks ago, I went and played in the festival. And that festival holds really funky significance to me because it's a really small place. And I have experienced a lot of like unwarranted and unexpected hospitality there. Mm-hmm. And the last time I went to that festival was 3 years ago because they had to cancel it for 2 years. And I got to the festival on a Friday after 7 hours of driving, because it's far from where I live. And I thought I was giving a concert on Saturday afternoon or Saturday evening. And the person who was supposed to be my accompanist had to back out of the festival for personal reasons. And somebody said, there's going to be an accompanist there who probably will be able to get together with you and accompany you for this. And I said, great. I'll get there Friday. I'll call him at night. We'll arrange time on Saturday to sit down and like acquaint with each other. I get there on Friday at 6:45 to find out I'm performing at Friday at 7:30. And I don't even have the number of the accompanist, nor have I asked him. So here I am. I'm like, okay, I am fucked. This is gonna be a failure. And I said, yet I still have to get up on stage in 45 minutes. And I asked somebody to give me this guy's number. And I texted him and then called him in a panic. Like, I thought I was performing tomorrow. I was going to ask you. He said, I'll play with you. Cool. I said, can I meet you so we can talk about what we do? Because we've never sat down to get to play and we're supposed to perform. And he said, yeah. We didn't actually rehearse. We sat down. And talked about what pieces I was going to play, what keys they were in so he can accompany me, what order. 10 minutes. And in that moment of crisis and survival, I said, what do I know in my repertoire that I can play at 3 a.m. with a hangover that is so safe that I can't mess it up? I had one of the best performances of my life because of all the expectation that I let go of.
Yes.
Fast forward to 3 weeks ago, I am in the same festival with the very same people in this incredibly inviting place in my life. And I get on stage and I lost my mind and made the biggest mistakes possible. And my recovery was okay, but I had to go afterwards and ask myself, what shoulders did I repress that came to take my attention away in a moment of performance? And I had to identify that there had been circumstances and people who made me feel intimidated and scared and uncomfortable this year, like they had not done so 3 years ago. And I had gone and said, you're not going to intimidate me. Go hide in the corner. You're not going to scare me. That's not significant enough to scare me, I judged. That doesn't matter. I have me to rely on. I suppressed all those micro fears. And I had to go and think how many of them were there. And there were several. And because none of them were significant, I had just brushed it under the rug until there were 7 of them in the under the rug. And that was a pile. And I sat down to play. And in the middle of my performance, I completely forgot what I was playing and where I was. Okay. That was a terrifying moment. And I just looked at the audience, gave a big smile, and bullshitted my way to the back, to the beginning of the piece. And people loved it, okay? So in a way, it brought my humanity to people because I wasn't some kind of an entity that is so perfect that nobody can touch. On the contrary, I am a human. And it was like, audiences connect with imperfection in a sense. But why did that happen? Was because I didn't connect with myself and I didn't acknowledge 7 or 70 or 360 micro intimidations that I had experienced because they were too small to acknowledge.
So knowing this, what might change? What will you do differently? How will you act differently?
Being present in my feelings sooner, with less gap between what happens and how I react. Being acknowledging of my feelings that this guy that I might have been flirting with 3 years ago came there with his girlfriend and no, she doesn't have much on me. But that was a little bit of a blow. Right? And this guy who like 3 years ago was kind of cold towards me was even colder and no, he doesn't matter, but that was a little bit of a blow. And those were subtle things that instead of saying, oh, you know what? That doesn't feel very good. I said, go hide in the corner. And they became shudders because I shushed them. And my wish is for there to be less of a lapse time between an event and me, my awareness of the emotion it caused. It used to be weeks. sometimes months and sometimes years. And sometimes now it is days and hours, but I want it to be seconds and minutes.
Isn't it sometimes?
Sometimes it is.
Yeah.
I am not saying that that never happens. I am saying that didn't happen that time.
Yeah.
And what I'm trying to do is I could have gone and just kind of buried my head in shame after that performance. And I wanted to be the sage who said, what lemonade can I make out of these lemons?
Yeah.
And so if this experience serves as a catalyst for me to shorten that gap between experience and awareness of emotion, then I took a mistake and made it a tool.
Yeah.
Now I add it to my symphonic orchestra.
It resonates a lot when I hear you speak about it that way, because that's how I worked with my anger, the irritant anger, the not holy rage anger, but the other type of anger. I was an angry mom. And when I started to work with that, because it's like the point came where it's like, I don't want to be an angry mom. So I put on awareness glasses of sorts, looking for anger. And it's like you said, I could be at work in the afternoon and it would hit me. Oh, shit. I yelled at one of the kids this morning. You know, I didn't pick up on it when I was yelling at the kid. I didn't pick up on it until, you know, hours later. And then gradually the time shortened.
Shrank,
precisely. I could pick it up as I was shouting. It's like, oh, shit, I'm there now. And then one magic moment, I picked up on it before I had started to shout. Precisely. It's like, bingo. Yes. Okay. This is what it feels like when I have the agency, when I have the awareness, the wherewithal, and the presence to say, do I want to shout at my kid right now? Do I want to use it? Precisely. Do I, you know, it's like, because it is a choice. I can do that or don't I? You know, what will serve me? What will serve them, etc.? What do I do right now? And if... Yeah. And that was a very visceral experience of coming to that point where, oh, shit, I haven't quite crossed the threshold yet. I'm just about to. Do I want to or don't I want to? Sage perspective. Yeah. What's the discerning thing to do right here? Now and again. Maybe shouting at your kid is a good thing. I don't know. I'm not saying it is. But, you know, it's like it or now and again, it's just, I don't give a fuck. I just feel like it. It's like, okay. Then I have to deal with the consequences of that. It's the choice. It's the thing. It's the agency. It's the awareness. It is being, okay, what do I do now? What do I need? What do they need, depending on who it is, what it is, my relationship to whatever. And it is a fantastic experience. So I've been this PQ program of someone called Shiel Saad, American coach or something. He's asking a lot of questions about, you know, put yourself in a situation when you lost it, or you know, when the saboteurs are there, or put yourself in a situation where your sage was there, etc. And I'm honestly having a hard time. I'm not very good at visualizations to start with, let's put it that way. So, but it's like, again, because most of my examples that come to mind have been professional settings. Right now, I don't have any kids at home. It's like, it's just me. I don't rub up against other people that way, that much, that I have a lot of examples from my personal life. I have more examples from my professional life. And I usually, with few exceptions, I usually do not turn saboteur. It's like my sage is quite there. So that muscle, I have trained that muscle. I have trained it. And yes, I want to put that into use for me personally, so that I don't keep at with this mental vice thing, etc.
But you've trained it in the professional field and not yet in the personal field. And
it's not like, as much in the personal field.
Sometimes it feels like you've trained on earth for moonwalking. And for moonwalking, you need to train on the moon.
Yeah. And you know, it's like, yes, and the astronauts actually train for moonwalking down here on Earth as well, to be able to do moonwalking when they're up there. So it is a yes, and I would say it's like, yes, I can't say that I will be great at moonwalking if I haven't been on the moon. I've just been training down here. But like you have...
those astronauts create moonlight conditions.
Also.
On Earth.
Also do same thing. You know, you have a soccer player. They don't just kick a ball around. They also swim or go to the gym or eat. You know, it's like, it is an also, I would say. So yes, you're right in that. But it's as if I'm, it gets easier and easier for me to do it in private situations as well.
Good.
Yeah. So I'm working it.
I can't say for myself that it's such a linear process for me. To me, it's a zigzag.
Oh, it's not just a zigzag. It's a complete jumble. You know, it's like it goes every which way, right? But yes, but in that every which way, I can still, it's like weather and climate. You know, the weather can be up, down, it's warm, it's cold, it's whatever, but there's a trend. Okay, where's the trend headed? So it's a total jumble, but I can see that there's a positive trend.
Yeah. I hope so. I really hope so.
Yeah.
For like both of us.
Yeah. But it's like I just the awareness and the, you know, the amount of grieving I do in therapy, the amount of crying for the me that has experienced what I've experienced. And again, I've not had a bad life at all. I've, you know, my parents weren't bad parents or anything. That doesn't matter. You still have shit happen that wasn't what you wanted or needed in the moment.
Absolutely. But
the grieving I do is just, it's.
But that's cathartic. Basically turning those shoulders into forecasters. Into proactive allies rather than retroactive
downshooters. Yeah, precisely. And that process, I think, is an interesting one, which is the same type of thing with the anger. Like, it used to be this retrospective, holy fuck, did I do that type of thing? And then closer and closer to the event, and then just prior to me erupting, going, hey, wait. Do you want to or don't you? You know, this is what's going to happen if you take one more step. Is that where you want to go? So, yes, it is really that that shift.
It's a timing thing, isn't it? Recognition sooner and sooner and sooner, and maybe before action.
Yeah. It's a timing thing. It's a sensitization thing. It's where I fine-tune my all of my little tentacles, all of my little sensors, so that I pick up on the signal that they're sending and I can put the picture together like before the event rather than, holy fuck, yeah, that was what happened back then.
And that's, I think, the only way to make the shudders be your symphony instruments rather than cannonballs that destroy your heart.
And I mean, you do want the violin to come in when it's time. You do want the trombone to make its, you know, tooting when it is the time. It's like not when the violin is having its very soft little solo, right? That's not when the trombonist should go, prank. Like, no. Right?
That would not be very good if it goes at that time.
No.
So, I know, but it's so hard to do at the same time. Like, it, I don't know. I think those ingrained habits, we have to keep on, like, putting them on the chopping block.
Yeah.
And re-examining and scrutinizing them again and again and again.
And you know, I've been pondering this because it's like, I'm pretty good at this. I'm pretty good at finding a habit and then putting it on the chopping block and reconstituting it into a new habit that is more akin to what I want in the moment or in the time being. So I'm pretty good at that. But I've been pondering the stories I tell myself about myself. And I have been saying for quite some time now that I'm not good at honoring my boundaries in my private life, or that I have this mental vice that keeps me from. It's like, I need to shift how I speak about this. I want to shift how I speak about this because I'm keeping myself inside of the mental vice. If I speak about it as if I'm inside of the mental vice, it's like, no, I need to, in essence, kind of give myself some space from it. Put that little in between, mellanrummet again, that will allow me to discern whether or not it is time to say or not say, whether or not it's time to move or not move. Because sometimes what the mental voice is saying is what's actually discerning, but how it's saying is from the saboteur point of view.
Yeah.
So it's not as if it's wrong. It's just the way that the message is given breaks me down. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, don't run into the street, you're going to get hit by a car, versus, hey, sidewalk is for pedestrians. You're a pedestrian right now. Enjoy the sidewalk.
Yeah.
When we're in a car, we'll be on the street.
And again, you know, I had yesterday I was at a client's place and I was working one of their standard operating procedures, and I'm updating it, and it's about it's a production site, so there's gowning procedures and what do you do with your shoes, etc. And we're adding a little clause about the shoes that you have in production, you put them up on a little rack when you go through the dressing room. And I was pondering, how do I say this in such a way that I'm saying what you should do? Not, don't put your shoes on the floor, but rather put your shoes on the little rack, right? Because just that. Don't run into the street because mm-hmm. there's car. It's like, no, I want to say the other thing, which is
what we should do instead of what we shouldn't do.
Yeah, yeah. What is the thing that is the wanted, the needed behavior, the required?
I say this a million times a day to my students, and then I don't follow it.
So there's the what do you practice, or what do you preach, or what do you tolerate?
Tolerate, yeah.
Yeah, in yourself.
In ourselves, first and foremost, and then from anybody else.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, well, I think that might be a good way to wrap this up. And I wonder if anybody else also has that same reaction to the Yoko quote. It's not what you preach, it's what you tolerate. Because we scrounged 90 minutes of conversation out of it. And we could probably go on for quite some time about it if we wanted to.
Great. I'm going to sit down with that.
Yeah.
And I feel like I've already been taking action on it without having it that concisely described.
Yeah.
But sometimes the description can make it so much easier to put to action.
Yeah. So. And it's like it's a little twist of so many like proverbs, like, you know, walk your talk, or you know, practice what you preach. It's like all of those stuff, but this one puts just that little slant that's just, oh, that's tankespian. It's like, there you go. There's tankespian. It's like, oh.
Gentle with the edge.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you for that. That was a gift.
You're welcome.
I don't know how I never heard it, but that was a good quote.
Yeah, it is a good one. Well, I hope that you make yourself a really, really lovely day. The rest of your day.
And I hope you take your walk.
I will take my walk. I will go out and take my barefoot walk for sure. And then I will send up our last conversation, just you and me. And then I will be sending out a doodle for us to find our communal conversation time. So that we can
get fun.
Yeah. I'm really looking forward to that. It's always great fun. So,
thank you, Helena.
Thank you, Bella. See you around. Tankespian has gotten an Instagram account. You will find it at instagram.com/tankespian. Not surprisingly. And I'm quite enjoying the process of putting out content that is more specifically tankespian, which doesn't mean that it isn't personal, that it isn't kind of introvertedly reflective, like quite a lot of my posts over on my personal account is. But it makes me able to shift my personal account at Helena Roth from Tankespian. And I'm enjoying the process. I'm enjoying the birth or the birthing process of what does the Tankesbjörn account want to be or become? What does it want to have happen? So even though Instagram has actually never been my favorite social media platform, I'm quite enjoying the process. So if you are on Instagram, I'd love it if you'd come over to Tankesbjörn and hit follow. So see you around. If not on Instagram, then maybe somewhere else. Enjoy.